Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and streaming live at KALW.org. I'm tonight's host of Your Legal Rights, Robert Wyman. And tonight we'll be discussing Social Security, and this is a very broad topic. The Social Security program encompasses retirement, disability, Medicare, Medicaid, and we're going to see if we can cover all these in 1 hour. And to help me out getting that accomplished in just an hour, I've got two excellent guests here in the studio with me tonight, two very experienced attorneys I've known for many years, Attorney Greg Catamole and Bernard Baltax. Greg Catamole and his associates practice law in San Mateo County. They handle personal injury cases, but they also handle Social Security disability. Bernard Baltax is a partner at Smith & Baltax. Bernie and his partner Byron Smith are both specialists in workers' compensation law. And I asked Bernie to join us tonight because Social Security and Medicare will regularly become issues in workers' compensation claims as well as personal injury claims, which is Greg's specialty. So Greg and Bernie, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for having me tonight.
Thank you very much.
And as always, we're eager to hear from our listeners, to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of the local dialing area, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you may call regarding any question on tonight's topic, Social Security laws and benefits, and you're not limited to the exact point that we may be in the conversation. If you have a question about any of the benefits available to you through the Social Security Administration, please feel free to call and we'll do our best to answer your question. Now, bear in mind that our guests cannot provide you with precise legal advice as they will not have all the facts relating to your case. However, we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. Our guests are here to educate and to inform. So, gentlemen, I thought we'd start with maybe the easiest one. Because Social Security, they do a lot of stuff. When I think of Social Security, I think of retirement. And I think of, you know, my dad and grandpa turning 65 and retiring and getting their Social Security benefit. But you don't have to get it at 65. Is that right?
You could take it early. You could start taking it at 62, I believe. But there's certain penalties that may be associated with working after that point in time.
And does the benefit change? I understand that you have to take it by a certain age, which is what, 70?
70.
Okay, so at 70 you have to start taking your retirement benefit. But you can start taking it at 62?
62. It's much less than you'd get if you waited till you're a full retirement age or you waited till age 70. And there are certain penalties associated with working while you're taking your retirement. Should you earn anything over about $23,000, you'll start having to pay back penalties for it.
So I could be 63 years old, still working. I could collect my Social Security retirement, but maybe that wouldn't be advantageous for me financially.
Might not be.
So, I don't think... Are any of us financial experts? No, we're not.
No.
So what we tell our clients when they come in the office is talk to a financial expert. Talk to your accountant. Hire a financial planner, even if just for a couple of hour session, to find out maybe at what age you should start taking your Social Security retirement benefit. I started us off with that topic because that's sort of the easiest one. Is there anything else that you can think of to add with regard to Social Security retirement?
No. Every one of us has a different full Social Security retirement age, at which point you could take it without worrying about it whether you work or not. If you've reached full retirement age, you could take your full retirement or your Social Security retirement and work without any penalties or repercussions.
And that that's sort of a sliding scale now, isn't it? It used to be 65, but for some people it's 66, some people it's 67. Is that correct?
Yeah, the younger you are, the longer you got to wait.
Okay. Okay. And have either of you ever gone on the Social Security website and played with the numbers?
I don't know if I played with the numbers.
Yeah, I've been on the website to, you know, to look at the information and that kind of thing. But yeah, I think there might be some kind of calculator on
it. It's really excellent. The entire Social Security website has a ton of information, and you log in like you would with any company. You get a login thing and a password, and you can actually look and see what your benefit would be at this age or that age. It tells you what your benefit will be if you take disability, which is something we're going to cover a bit later.
I think that's called My Social Security.
Yeah, yeah. So we get Social Security simply because we paid into it and we're retiring at some age between 62 and 70. But a more sort of complex benefit is Social Security disability. And that's something your office handles, correct, Greg?
I do, yeah.
And is there an age limit at which one can apply for Social Security disability?
There's no age limit. You could be a minor child with a severe disability or significant disability, including learning disabilities, that for which you could apply for Social Security disability benefits or supplemental security income benefits.
What's supplemental Social Security?
Supplemental security income benefits is a needs-based program. That is, if you haven't paid into the Social Security system or acquired enough quarters or units to qualify for disability insurance, you can apply for supplemental security income.
And that might be the minor you're talking about, who's never worked. They've never paid into Social Security.
Right, exactly. And it provides much less of a benefit, but it's still available to you, and it has some of the benefits associated with Social Security disability, including eligibility for Medicare.
But for those who have worked for a few years, they can then apply for Social Security disability. SSDI is how I've always heard it called.
And, yeah, it's basically an insurance program you purchase with your work efforts. And, Bernie, I don't know if you know how many – I keep forgetting how many quarters you have to accumulate in a certain period of time to qualify for Social Security disability. But if you can qualify, but if you stop working and wait to apply for Social Security disability, you may lose that benefit because it's like an insurance policy. You buy it, you pay into it, and if you stop paying for it, you may lose it.
So if you stop working because of an accident or an injury, it's probably a good idea to reach out to Social Security to find out if you're eligible.
Yeah, once you've been offered a certain period of time, yes, absolutely.
So if someone has an injury, frequently my clients will say, well, gee, I can't go back to my job. Can I get Social Security? But there's more to it than that. It's not just the inability to do one's regular job. Is that right?
That's right. You've got to be unable to engage in any substantial gainful employment. That's the magic word for Social Security. Essentially what it means is you can't work at any job due to your disability or cumulative disabilities that prohibits you from engaging in work.
And so, Bernie, you'll see clients come into your office. You do workers' compensation. They've had a work injury. They can't go back to their own job. But do you question them about other illnesses or other medical conditions they might have?
Absolutely. If you have a work injury, that injury in and of itself may take you out of the labor force or out of the labor market and then render you eligible for Social Security. But the injury itself may not be severe enough to make you qualify for Social Security, but you may have other health issues, other problems, maybe other injuries that you'd had, and the combination of those do put you into Social Security.
So if I feel like I can't work anymore, where do I start? I somehow contact Social Security. What do I apply? What do I do?
What I tell my clients when they call me and they've got a disability, they feel they're disabled, I encourage them to apply through the Social Security website. You go to the Social Security Disability, it'll guide you right through it. Apply on their own. Fill out an application. Read the website first. It'll tell you what you need to have available to you. Medical reports, lists of medications, names and addresses of doctors. Go online and do it yourself, because if you have a significant disability, you may very well qualify the first time, and therefore you avoid attorney fees. Attorneys are hired at a contingency basis. They pay 25% of back due benefits or $7,200, whichever is less.
Okay, so as soon as you're hired, they're going to have to pay a fee.
Yeah.
But if they can fill out the application on their own, if they're severely injured and get accepted, then they save that money.
Yeah, if you do it right and you provide the authorization forms for them, they will acquire the records and delve into them themselves and do it for you.
Yeah, Bernie?
Well, I should say that, of course, you don't have to just been injured in a work type of injury. It could be any type of injury that you have. Obviously, if it's a work injury, you may have a workers' comp lawyer that can help you get your medicals together. But it doesn't have to be, obviously, a work-related injury for you to qualify for Social Security disability. And I was going to ask Greg, isn't it true that depending on your age, that test for whether you qualify or you can work in the open labor market, it's a little easier if you're like over 50 versus under 50 and you have that same injury?
Yeah,
is that right?
Yes, absolutely. I tell my clients all the time, Social Security truly believes in the adage, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And so if you've been working in an industry for a lot of years and you're 55, even 50 and over, it gets easier to qualify for disability insurance under the Social Security guidelines. They evaluate your transferable skills, what you can bring to other jobs in the industry, but also look at where you've been your entire life. So yeah, it does get easier the older you get.
So if someone's 58 and they've been a laborer their entire life, Social Security, I guess, recognizes it's pretty hard for them to find other employment.
Yeah, they haven't got transferable skills to go to a sedentary job.
I see.
But I should say it's not just injuries, and it's also diseases. There is a group of illnesses recognized by Social Security, which are called compassionate allowances, that'll qualify you for Social Security disability immediately. Blindness is one of them. I've had the experience for Lou Gehrig's disease. ALS is a compassionate allowance. Celine Dion has it. It's the stiff person syndrome, also qualifies under compassionate allowance. So if you've been diagnosed with an illness which is progressive in some form, you should look into applying for Social Security sooner rather than later because it may be automatically qualified.
I had a client in that situation. She needed a kidney transplant, and that's the first time I learned that she qualified automatically.
Yes.
Because she needed. And going on Social Security disability doesn't mean you have to stay on Social Security disability for life, does it?
No. You can go back to work, and they have programs that allow you to ease back into the workforce. You can still get some benefits for 3 to 6 months while you're easing back into the workforce. And if it fails, it's called a failed attempt to return to work, and you can go back on.
Yeah, because that's what happened with this client. Once she had her kidney transplant recuperated, she returned back to work and notified Social Security and at some point her benefits stopped, but she was back working again. So it's you can go on Social Security if you have a serious illness. I believe you have to prove that you're going to be out of the labor market for at least a year.
It's usually a year or more unless you have a terminal illness.
Okay.
Or one of the compassionate allowances.
Yeah, in her case, I think it wasn't even a year, but because it was compassionate allowance, I didn't even know that was the name for it. She collected her Social Security for 6-9 months, something like that, and then returned to the workforce. So
yeah.
For most of our clients, usually they're leaving the workforce forever, but not necessarily. If the injuries or illness is severe enough, and it makes sense, doesn't it, that Social Security would want to encourage people to try and get back into the workforce?
Absolutely.
And you can do some part-time work also. You could be on Social Security disability and be working as long as you're under a certain threshold. You can actually have a part-time job and still be on Social Security disability.
So, Greg, they've applied on their own, as you suggested they do.
Yeah.
And they will. Social Security will help people gather up the records. These days, it's pretty easy to go to a doctor's office and say, can you just give me a disc or just give me a thumb drive with all my records? But Social Security will help people gather their records, as you said earlier. So you've gathered all the records, you put in your application, get a denial. What happens next?
You have 60 days to do something once you receive the letter. And in that 60 days, the first step is to file a petition for reconsideration. an application for reconsideration, where somebody at the Social Security Administration will review it and make a decision, supposedly anew, looking at new records, old records, maybe have you evaluated by a doctor of some sort.
And that's interesting because in so many areas of the law, there's all these rules that if you sort of don't get your evidence in by this date, you can never bring it in. But Social Security allows you, when you're asking them to reconsider, to bring in more evidence if that's what's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. You could submit records anytime.
Oh, okay.
Now, whether they'll be looked at for the new reconsideration, it depends on when they're looking at it.
Okay. So hopefully Social Security reconsiders.
Hopefully the new eyes see more light and give you the benefits.
But what if they don't?
Then you request a hearing before an administrative law judge.
And I'm thinking that somewhere between the application and this hearing is when it's time to call a Social Security attorney.
Yeah, I usually suggest for the application for reconsideration, you call an attorney and get them involved at that point. Because then I like to analyze it from that point and secure the medical records I can. And if there is availability to get a report or you got a doctor willing to write a supplemental report, you can get it and submit it and document the record and hopefully get somebody to take a look at it and recognize the extent of disability.
And if that all fails, you mentioned at some point there's actually a hearing. There's a actual you go before a judge. I don't know. Are they doing them live these days, or are they Zoom? Are they back?
Unfortunately, the ones that are doing it live are in Fresno.
Oh, okay.
they're doing them live. I've recently had a live hearing in San Francisco. I've had one in Fresno, and I don't think Oakland's done them live. They'll do it by phone or by video at that point.
And are these hearings as formal as the things we see on television on Law and Order and all that? Are they a little more informal?
A little more informal. Quite informal.
Okay.
But the judge is still running a courtroom. They're still under time constraints. They're trying to hear 3 to 4 cases in a morning or an afternoon. So it's rather hurried, but they're familiar with the file. And it differs from judge to judge. What the judge wants, what the judge wants to hear, and whether or not the judge allows the attorney to question or the judge will question the person.
So it could be either attorney and... Or maybe both would question the applicant. Is that what they're called in Social Security, an applicant? Or they have a name?
I call them they're usually referred to as beneficiaries under the system, but
okay.
Claimants, I usually call them. But, yeah, and they usually have at the hearing before an administrative law judge, they will have experts. They'll have vocational rehabilitation expert testify as to what jobs are available within the open economy that you can do with the parameters of your disability. And sometimes they'll have a medical expert testify.
I was surprised to learn that lay people can testify as well, because I was asked to testify as a lay person at a Social Security hearing. They just wanted me to say, you've observed this person. You know, what is it that's keeping them from working? And as it turns out, they had me fill out a form first, a letter basically explaining. And the judge just basically told the attorney, this letter is sufficient. I don't need the test. Probably because they're trying to get quite a few hearings done. But what they wanted to know is things that a doctor may not notice, like, you know, this individual has trouble sleeping at night, has PTSD, has terrible nightmares, and therefore they end up sleeping fitfully during the daytime. It's very hard for them to keep on a schedule.
Yeah.
And it's something about keeping on the schedule that really caught the judge's interest and turned a loss into a victory for this particular person.
Yeah, that's if I can find. It's called how often are you off task? That is, how often does your disability prevent you from attending work? Or from being attentive during the workday, completing an 8-hour day.
Oh, Phil from San Rafael, welcome to Your Legal Rights. How can we help
Hi.
You?
Yes, I have an interesting predicament. I have a son with cerebral palsy. He is he's 29 years old. He's a quadriplegic, and we're trying to procure a new power wheelchair for him. And we run into a kind of a labyrinth of disqualifying parameters. And to make it very simple, he can't safely drive the chair himself. And so when we buy a chair, it basically has a second joystick on the handlebar in the back, and the attendant drives the chair. When we're in situations like in a public park or someplace in open space, he can drive the chair and gets a lot of pleasure from it. But in terms of real safety, he can't accurately drive a chair down a sidewalk and, you know, see the edge of the curb. And so it turns out that even though he's on Social Security disability, when we try to apply to get a chair, we're disqualified because he can't drive it himself. And they say, well, you just have to get a manual chair. The problem being that he weighs 200 pounds, and then the chairs themselves weigh like 150 pounds. You've got a 350-pound package in total. And then the attendant staff people that I hire to take care of him cannot push him up even the smallest ramp, like the ramp into our van. And it seems like there's the rules are set up so that, you know, you just completely disqualified. And to make it worse, when they say that we can't fund this, I say, well, what, just in a perfect world, let's say I had the money and I was to buy it myself out of pocket, they still won't sell me the chair because they are licensed Medi-Cal and Medicare providers. They have to abide by the same rules for that are coming through the Medicare parameters, and they won't even sell me the chair privately. So I don't know if this is even applicable to your guest, but I just don't know how to navigate it. And you know, it's a place where the bureaucracy overall is stifling and making, and it's actually impeding the quality of my son's life, because I can't put him in the chair that he actually needs to be in. He's actually in one now, but it's 8 years old, and here we are trying to, you know, kind of sort this out again. Curious if you have any insights.
Yeah, this might be a little bit outside our field, because basically what the three of us do is try to get people past that judge and get Social Security approved for them. But Greg, has something like this ever come up in your practice?
No. The first thought I had is I can't believe you can't purchase it yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems a little bizarre, but
I was surprised by that too. But when I asked the vendor, they said we are licensed to sell through, you know, our rules are set up by Medicare essentially. And even if you're paying it for yourself, we still have to play by those rules.
Well, ask them who they buy it from.
Well, they're buying it from the manufacturer, but I guess there's some kind of liability standard or something, you know. They sell me the chair and he drives off the edge of a sidewalk and cracks his head open, then they're liable. I'm not really sure. I can't get straight information from them.
Are you working with any of the organizations concerning your son's disability? I had the unfortunate experience of having a family member with the ALS, with the Lou Gehrig's disease.
Right.
And my sister-in-law found initial help with the organizations to go there to find help guide. Now she's
That's
helping others now, but I think you might try that. They might be able to give you some insight on what to do and to help you, and maybe even navigate it for you.
Yeah, they have the organization is United Cerebral Palsy. Yeah. I'll check in with them and see if they have some insights. Thank you for that.
And one quick thing, just a question for you, is when you're getting these denial letters, are they coming from an outfit called CMS, the Center for Medicaid Services? Is that who you're dealing with?
Well, I haven't received a letter like that directly this time around. At this point, it was basically what they did is they told me that I needed to, he had to go get an evaluation, both from a primary doctor to prove that he already has the cerebral palsy that he obviously already has, and then go to an occupational therapist that I guess needs to determine his skill set and, you know, fine motor control, essentially. Can he use a joystick and, you know, drive down a hallway without banging into the walls? And that's where he was not able to do that. And they said, well, we cannot authorize him for a power chair, and Medicare will only pay for a a self-driven chair, because they consider a chair driven by an attendant to be benefiting the attendant and not the person sitting in the chair.
And this does get a bit far afield from some of the issues that I deal with clients that are on Medicare, and I'm dealing with this outfit called CMS. But what I have found is that getting things in writing regularly, just paper them with your request to show that, believe it or not, it sometimes works. I had one client just had a terrible time with CMS. I said, just start writing him a letter every week. Every week, send him a letter. And before long, someone called him up. They sat down, they talked, and they got the problem resolved. So I've found that when you can get to the right employee, they can be helpful. The letters are terrifying when you get them that just say, give us this money back or we're not providing this. But you get a human being on the phone, they'll actually try to work with you to show you how to get what the benefit you're trying to receive.
Have you talked to your congressman?
I haven't, but that's also a good idea.
I think if you get the right person in your congressman's office, it could be a really beneficial, a help to you, to your son. They are great advocates for their constituents in these type of situations.
And I was going to suggest that too, and you might also consider state legislators and senators too.
Every member of Congress has people on staff that are there for constituent service to help people in just this situation. So get them involved in writing, and I wish the best for you. Thank you
very
for calling
good.
In.
Thank you. Appreciate your good advice. Thank you.
Okay. Have a good evening. So we were talking about the hearing, and the hearing that's before a Social Security judge, is that pretty much the last stop?
No, unfortunately.
So, I mean, hopefully they win. They've got Greg there, you know.
After a hearing, if you get a unfavorable decision, it's favorable, unfavorable, partially favorable. I think those are only three that I've seen. Once you get a decision that's unfavorable or partially unfavorable and you want to challenge it, you write an appeal to the Appeals Council. And you set forth the reasons, the basis, any additional evidence which wasn't available during the hearing or at the time of the hearing, and you submit it to the Appeals Council. The Appeals Council will review it and determine whether or not it should have been overturned or should have been granted. It should have been a favorable decision, a fully favorable decision, or if it should have been, it should be sent back for further hearings. If that fails, I'm not aware of an interim program that'll help or you can go through, but then you have to file a lawsuit with the Federal District Court. It's basically against the Commission for the Medicare, the Medicare Commissioner, and you go to court and you essentially brief the matter and have a hearing on it, potentially. It's usually not through a hearing, and have a judge decide or a magistrate from the federal court.
And I guess a bit of good news in all this is that the benefits are retroactive. So if you do have to go through the reconsideration, the hearing, the appeals, if you eventually prevail, the benefits go back to what, when you apply?
Is it 5 months after the date of disability? The date is determined to be the date of disability?
But someone could get potentially several years worth of back benefits.
Yeah.
And I've been told, in worst case scenario, one can apply again, but then you lose those back benefits. In other words, you could start the whole process over again down the road, but then you lose all the retroactive benefits. So you want to keep appealing as much as you can to keep that original claim alive.
I mean, I've seen in my practice in workers' comp where somebody might have an injury. It's not that severe, not severe enough.
And we have a call from Frank in San Francisco. Frank, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hi, it's Fran.
Fran, sorry, Fran.
It's okay. Yeah. I have a quick question about Social Security, not disability. I've always wanted to know if two married people each get Social Security and one person dies, does the other one get the other person's Social Security?
I think
In other words, they have to pay bills and they've been used to living on two Social Securities and somebody dies. What can you tell me?
It's the higher of the two. So yeah. Who's ever, if the spouse, the spouse that that died has the higher Social Security than the surviving spouse, the surviving spouse gets that higher amount.
But they just get the one check at that point. Yeah, they just get the one, but they do get, out of the two checks, they get the higher of the two.
Oh. Well, thank you very much. I hope that helps somebody else out.
Well, thank you for calling, Fran.
And thank you for the program.
Oh, you're welcome. And at 6:30, we're going to take a short break to allow the station to identify itself. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM and streaming on KALW.org.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. And now back to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Joanne. And tonight we're discussing Social Security laws and benefits. And I'm Robert Wyman here in the studio with Greg Cattermole and Bernard Baltax, Bernie, we call him. Our phone number here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the local dialing area, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And I sort of broke this program tonight down to four benefits. And the next one I want to discuss is another one that probably won't need to spend a lot of time on, but that's Medicaid. And Medicaid actually is a federal program, but it's run by each of the states. So here we call it Medi-Cal. Is that... But they're the same thing, is that right?
You know, I really don't understand the relationship. But if you're on Medicaid, what I've had experience, they're on Medi-Cal.
Or you're on Medi-Cal.
Paid through the Medi-Cal program.
And for many of my clients who find themselves unemployed and lose their health insurance, Medicaid is a needs-based program, so that if you simply can't afford health insurance on your own, Medicaid will come to the rescue. They do request financial records, but one of the advantages is that, for the most part, the care is at no fee to the Medi-Cal recipient. The treatment's free, basically.
The Medicaid recipient.
Correct. And the other sort of bit of advice I would throw out there is I tell my clients, go to the website. I'm sitting here in front of me. I printed up today something called My Medi-Cal. And it's right on the Medi-Cal website, Department of Healthcare Services. And it's just an excellent brochure. It's about 20 pages. It tells you how to apply, what the standards are. And also, we have Covered California here. And if you find yourself without insurance, Bernie, you probably find you've got clients that lose their insurance.
Absolutely.
You send them over to Covered California?
Yeah. I mean, if you are... someone who has lost your health insurance because you lose your job, either to because of a work injury or any reason, you can get coverage under the Affordable Care Act, and there are low cost options for you. And if you are super indigent, then you've got your Medi-Cal, security.
So that's sort of part of the Affordable Care Act. If you have some income, they'll get you a properly priced plan. But if you really have no funds, then you qualify for Medi-Cal.
Yeah, and I've had clients who, because of workers' compensation benefits they may be receiving, they may lose their Medi-Cal, but they will still be able to get health insurance if they go through Covered California.
Okay, so again. There's not a lot that lawyers do with this, but I wanted to bring it up because it is an important benefit that is provided that you're paying for with your out of every paycheck. And the two places to go are to the Medi-Cal website and to Covered California. And
Rob, they've raised the basis for qualifying for Medi-Cal last year. So it's much higher and much more open to recipients who felt they couldn't qualify because maybe they had benefits coming in through a work comp case. But now you can, or you own a home, or you own some property or something that may you don't want to sell, you don't want to do something with, so you can qualify for Medi-Cal benefits a little easier than you used to be able to.
So you don't have to sell the home and get rid of all the assets to
qualify. There are some penalties later on if you use it, if you might have to get money back from the property, but
okay.
That's a whole different issue.
All right. But bottom line is get online, call. And I've, again, found that the employees for both Medi-Cal and Covered California are really fantastic. I love to get my digs in with the insurance companies because they don't like to give out money. But these folks actually want to help you get your benefits.
I found that my clients go to the Social Security offices. They're very helpful in guiding them through the process there, too.
Now, the last sort of big topic for tonight, and this was where my two guests will get involved frequently, is Medicare. And we start off the program discussing the fact that at 65, you just automatically get Medicare.
If you apply.
Yeah, you have to apply.
You have to apply.
You got to fill out. It's a very simple form, but it's got to be done.
Got to carry that blue, red, white, and blue card.
In fact, it could be done on, because I just did this myself, They look at the month you turn 65, and the first day of that month you can become eligible, and you can apply 3 months before that. So someone born May 15th could start the process on February 1st. And our insurance guy told me, don't wait. It's a simple process, but don't put it off. As soon as you are within 3 months of your 65th birthday, start applying for Medicare. Just to make sure it's ready for you when you turn 65. Medicare doesn't cover everything, does it?
No.
So for those of us in the room, one of us is not there yet. Bernie, you're still waiting, so listen.
Anxiously awaiting.
Listen to your elders here. One can simply have Medicare and nothing else. Is that right, Greg?
That's right. Absolutely.
But that's probably not a good idea.
No, you want to, if assuming you can afford it, you want to buy a supplemental policy to back up what Medicare might not cover. Some medication costs, there's out-of-pocket expenses, there's copays under Medicare.
And I understand there's two basic programs. There's the Medicare Advantage programs and what are known as Medigap programs. And they're two separate systems. And you sort of have to go into one or the other. So, for example, Kaiser is an Advantage program.
Right.
So if you have Kaiser membership and turn 65, they'll actually guide you through the process of switching over if you like Kaiser and staying with Kaiser and you become a Kaiser Advantage member. And what are some of the advantages that one has once one turns 65, Greg?
Advantages for?
Being 65 and having the Medicare program available to you.
You're not paying some of the outrageous premiums you pay for regular medical insurance. Your access to care is just the same. It might be a little better in your basic insurance program. If you get a supplement, it covers you. The cost is maybe half, maybe lower than half of what you pay as an individual for okay insurance, but not great insurance. It's a much better program.
And we do pay for Medicare. It comes out of, for example, if someone's on Social Security, they take a deduction for basic Medicare coverage.
Correct.
So even though we've been paying for our whole lives, we're still paying for it once we turn 65.
Yeah, it's not totally free.
Okay. Yeah. And if one is working, what happens?
The more you earn, the higher the premium goes.
And they just send you a bill.
Yeah, they send you a bill or they take it out of, if you're taking Social Security retirement, they might take it out of your Social Security retirement.
And if you're not taking Social Security retirement, what, they send you a bill?
They send you a bill. They bill you.
Okay.
And there's a max, and I can't remember the max.
It's in the $400 to $500 range,
yeah.
I think, is the most anyone has to pay.
And then you may pay a supplement, a premium on a supplement you purchase to coordinate with Medicare. I do it through a broker who set up everything, and it was really easy and not that expensive.
And I called around and just talked to different – I mean, they all wanted to sell me their program. But I called four or five different insurance companies and said, what does your program offer? And there's different plans at different prices. So you pay a higher deductible or a lower deductible or a higher out-of-year cap, lower cap, and that's the most you have to pay every year. It's a dollar amount. Beyond that, you don't have to pay anymore for your treatment. And that dollar amount varies depending upon the type of plan you get.
Exactly.
So those are all things you want to take into consideration when you're applying for Medicare. But getting back to what we were discussing before, people who end up on Social Security disability, even at, say, age 30 or 40, can they become eligible for Medicare?
They can.
Yeah.
It's 2 years after you qualify for Social Security disability. So is it two and a half? I think it's 2 years after you're on Social Security disability, you qualify for Medicare.
So in that gap, you've got to go to Covered California. You've got to go to Medi-Cal to make sure you're covered if you're not working and you're on Social Security disability. But about 2 years after you're accepted, then you automatically become eligible for Medicare.
Correct. So, yeah, you don't get it right away when you first qualify for Social Security disability, but you are guaranteed, as long as you stay on Social Security disability for 2 years, you're going to get it.
It's automatic.
Well, you still have to apply.
You have to apply, but it's automatic.
And they will take the premiums out of your monthly benefit.
Right. Okay. So here's where lawyers get involved. Bernie, you're a workers' comp specialist, and you're wrapping up a claim. And I love it when this happens. Just about to settle, client calls you up and says, "Hey, I just got accepted on Social Security disability. How's that going to change what you do?"
I start to cry.
Yeah.
No. It's not a problem necessarily. You can settle your workers' compensation case and be on Social Security or be on Medicare, but you do have to, in preparing the settlement, you have to, quote unquote, take Medicare's interest into consideration. So oftentimes that's done with something called a Medicare set-aside, which is somewhat complicated, but it doesn't have to be done that way necessarily. It depends on the threshold and what the insurance company is willing to do, because obviously a settlement of any legal matter is an agreement between two parties, so you have to get everybody on board. But there you will have to take special steps and get special permissions even sometimes to settle your workers' compensation case if you're on either Social Security, particularly if you're on Medicare.
I tell clients you need to get Social Security's blessing.
Correct.
Because if you don't do that and you settle a workers' compensation case and just show up at Medicare and ask them to treat you, they'll say, "Well, wait a minute. Wasn't part of your workers' comp settlement not just your permanent disability and other benefits, but some of that money you received was to pay your medical bills in the future."
Right. That's the remedy that Medicare may have against you. If you didn't take Medicare's interest into consideration, they will come back and say, "Well, we're not going to provide treatment for these body parts that were covered in the settlement because you didn't take our interest into consideration." And you don't always have to have their blessing ahead of time. Oftentimes, especially if it's big money, then we do get their blessing ahead of time, because the insurance companies won't pay big money if they don't have that blessing, because they don't want Medicare to come after them.
And as I understand it, Medicare, if they feel like their interests were not taken into consideration, so someone settles their workers' compensation case for a small amount of money and then they want to go get a knee replacement, Medicare can go after the insurance company, the employer, the injured worker's attorney, the attorney for the insurance company. Medicare can go after any of them.
Yeah, they consider themselves to be, have a long arm. And so they don't necessarily choose to exercise it all the time, but they have that as a threat. And especially when, in what I do in workers' comp, we're always dealing with insurance companies, and insurance companies, they don't, they like to play very strict by the rules. as you would expect.
So let's talk a little bit about the Medicare set-aside. And this is the type of thing that we lawyers go to conventions and conferences and seminars to learn about this, so we don't mess it up for our clients. It could be a topic of an entire hour. But basically, as I understand it, the injured worker is settling their workers' compensation case completely. They're closing it out. And we have to allocate some portion of that settlement to their future medical needs. So if it's a $100,000 settlement, we might say, well, $30,000 of it is to cover their medical needs.
Right. So it does. There are two ways of settling a workers' compensation case. We don't have to get too much into the weeds. But one way is with medical treatment closed, where you've received compensation to relieve the insurance company, the workers' comp insurance company, from providing any future medical treatment. So when you're doing that, you have to oftentimes get these Medicare set-asides. So, for example, let's say the $100,000 settlement, $50,000 of that is future medical. You may have a Medicare set-aside of $25,000, and just giving numbers. And so that portion, the $25,000, you would keep separate and you would use for Medicare.
And they literally do mean keep it separate. It has to be in its own interest-bearing checking or savings account.
Right. So if you got a $100,000 settlement, you didn't get all of it because there were some attorney's fees, but you receive the majority of it, maybe $85,000 under most circumstances, and $25,000 in my example, you would have to have in a separate bank account, and that $25,000 you would use to write a check to a provider when you wanted treatment that was otherwise covered by Medicare.
So the question I get, so
for
I'll play.
For body parts injured in the
absolutely.
Work-related
injury. Yes.
Just the things that were injured in the work injury. So I'm your client, Bernie, and we're talking about settlements and should I keep my medical care open? Should I close it? And you tell me, well, I can get you some extra money to close it, but you know you can't go buy a boat with it. You've got to put it aside and spend it on treatment. My first question too would be, well, why bother then? Why not just leave the medical care open and let the workers' compensation carrier pay for it?
Yeah, two reasons. One is you have control over the medical treatment as opposed to the workers' compensation system. The workers' compensation system, since the employer through their carrier pays for the medical treatment, they also get to exercise some control over that medical treatment. So if you get them out of the system, you now have much better control.
You can go to the doctor you want to go to.
You have unlimited control. As long as a doctor prescribes it and Medicare pays for it, you've got the account. You're sitting on the money, so you can pay for it yourself. You are the decider.
And you don't have to wait for approvals. You don't have to wait for reviews. You don't have to wait to find out if your prescription's approved. You just go get your prescription and pay for it out of that set-aside account.
Correct. And the other reason why you would still do it is that generally a portion of the money that you're going to receive is not encumbered in the way that a Medicare set-aside is. You could call it an encumbrance, you know, because it's you don't have total control over it. Some of the money you're going to get, you do have total control over, and you could buy a boat if it was enough. So,
but whatever amount, and this is when you probably a good idea to have a workers' comp lawyer help you if you're negotiating a settlement and you're on Social Security disability.
Absolutely, because generally the insurance companies will try to get you just with the MSA, and that's the value of the medical treatment. And as we've learned here, Medicare doesn't pay for everything. So you have to ensure that the settlement covers things that goes beyond just what Medicare is responsible for. You would not want to do that yourself without a lawyer.
So for example, Medicare doesn't cover vision, but if someone has an eye injury as part of their claim, you want to make sure there's extra money in there.
Exactly. Money over the MSA.
And the MSA is that set-aside that we're talking about. That's that. And then when they've got their money sitting in the account and they've been going to the doctor and writing their checks and the money runs out, then what happens?
So if the money runs out, the agreement that is made is that Medicare will cover 100%. So as long as you do your accounting, and that's the reason why you get a separate bank account, it makes the accounting very easy. You do your accounting and you provide that to Medicare, and Medicare will then pay for any treatment beyond the MSA.
Now, Greg, you're over there doing a personal injury lawsuit. And your client calls you and says, Greg, I just got on. Now, hopefully, they've already told you about this because you do both. You do personal injury and you do Social Security work. But if they sort of surprise you and say, hey, I just got accepted to on Social Security disability, how is that going to impact the settlement of your personal injury claim?
Social Security disability, not so much. Medicare, in the personal injury field, they haven't perfected a system for protecting their interests because there's so many issues out there that will affect it. Liability, comparative fault, jury verdicts, things like that nature that are unpredictable. And so they have a difficult time doing a hard, fast rule. But at the same time, just like you know what Bernie says, in our case, we have to protect the interests of Medicare in the larger cases where they're on Medicare or likely to be on Medicare in the future. And we do that through, I do it through other law firms that are specialists in it and help set it up. But you've got to protect their interests in the future. Failure to do so, it could lead to, deprivation of benefits later on, maybe some legal action by Medicare. So we do. It's not as steadfast or not as hard fast as workers' comp where they know that you're entitled to future medical, so they want to protect their interests against future medical.
Because in the personal injury world, you don't get an ongoing award of medical care. You just get a check.
No, yeah. And that's the problem. The only way you know if you get future medical is to go to a jury and get a jury verdict. It says, this is what you get for the future.
Oh, so in that case, the jury is going to break it down and say, well, you're getting this much for your lost wages and this much for your medical.
Exactly.
But if it's a settlement...
It's a compromise.
Exactly. Okay. So you're going to get somebody involved to make sure, again, that Medicare is brought in and they are approving this.
Well, they don't go through that process, but we do it to dot the I's and cross the T's that we've considered Medicare's interest, and maybe we're designating this much as what's the future cost of medical care.
Okay.
From the settlement.
So another issue, and this sort of gets back to what these all sort of cross each other, and they go back and forth and back and forth. There's another issue out there that we run into in the workers' comp world, and I don't know if you run into it as well, Greg, but if our client's actually getting a Social Security check and they get benefits from a private disability insurance policy, they get benefits perhaps from workers' compensation, can that have an impact on their monthly Social Security check?
It certainly can. Oftentimes when we are settling a workers' comp case, if it's a lump sum settlement, we will put in some language in the settlement to string out the payments for the life expectancy of the injured worker and thereby reduce the monthly income that they're receiving through workers' comp. Or it's a way of framing the money in a way such that it shows them underneath the threshold. So depending on how much you receive in a workers' compensation settlement or from any source, if you receive a certain amount of income, that could affect your Social Security disability. I don't think it affects your retirement at all.
Right, just the disability check. And again, that's an area where if someone has a workers' compensation claim and they're contemplating a settlement, you might want to talk to an attorney to try and minimize or perhaps even eliminate, and it's perfectly legal, to sort of take that lump sum, spread it out over time, and show Social Security, really, this $100,000 check isn't that much when you figure it's taking the place of 20 years worth of benefits.
Right. These are called Hartman formulas and from a case, but the point of it is that this money needs to be looked at in terms of when you have a work injury, the money that you're receiving, that's for you to have and use and for the remainder of your life. So this money is something that you're getting throughout your life, and it has to be viewed that way. And so it's not nearly as much money as it appears at first blush when you spread it out over your lifetime.
And a bit of advice I give clients, I'll ask you about this, what you do with personal injury cases is, I always tell my clients, for goodness sake, tell each, if you're getting checks from different entities, you're getting checks from a workers' compensation carrier, you're getting a check from a private disability policy, you're getting a check from Social Security, tell each one of them what you're getting from the others.
That's very important, because what happens is it then comes back at the settlement stage, because that's when the other parties start to get interested, and then all of a sudden issues come up.
Because Social Security doesn't always, there's an offset. They have a formula. They don't take all of your money away. But some of these long-term disability policies will say, well, we take a dollar-for-dollar credit. Every dollar you get from another system is a dollar we're not going to pay you.
That's right.
And you don't want them coming after you down the road saying, you got all this money while we were paying you. Pay us back.
That's right. And you know, many long-term policies, disability policies also require you to apply for Social Security disability, for example. And you may not want to do that. So you have to really look at these private policies and decide whether in the like I do this in the context of workers' comp, and I would imagine in Social Security too, just to ensure that it's the right time to apply for it. It might not be the right time to apply for it.
And is that something that comes up in your practice, Greg? Someone is on Social Security disability, but they're getting a nice big check from their personal injury case. Is that going to affect?
Really doesn't affect it that much, because that's for an injury for compensation for other damages. It doesn't impact your Social Security disability benefits like other programs do, like a disability policy or a work comp policy. Oh, like a work comp policy. So not so much in the personal injury field.
Okay, because I'm familiar with that term, the Hartman formula, and it's a formula that we use in workers' compensation. Is that something you ever have to deal with in the personal injury?
Not in the personal injury field.
Okay. Well, we're just about at the end of the hour. Any last thoughts, anything that you'd like to any wisdom you want to impart to our guests before we sign off for the evening?
One thing I didn't mention is that if you get on Social Security disability, you also have available benefit and additional sums of money for dependents in your family, children under the age of 18, or somebody who's disabled and that you're caring for, which might be a benefit on top of what you receive from Social Security disability.
Oh.
And I would just say, you know, sometimes people are afraid to apply for Social Security because they're afraid how it might impact their workers' comp case. And I would generally say, don't worry about that. Let the workers' comp person take care of it. You're going to get the money on the from the Social Security, so...
A good workers' compensation attorney will maximize it. And generally, you do better by having both.
Yeah,
You're never going to come out with less by applying for both.
Peace of mind's worth it, you know, to get the money coming in and the Medicare, hopefully.
All right. Well, I think peace of mind is a good way to end the program for tonight. So I'd like to thank you both for being here. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight we've been discussing Social Security law and benefits. And our guests have been Greg Catamole from the law office of Greg Catamole in San Mateo and Bernard Baltax of Smith & Baltax in San Francisco. Tonight's show is produced by yours truly, Robert Wyman. Please tune in next week, 6 p.m. on Wednesday, where, as always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. Thanks again to our guests, and on behalf of Your Legal Rights, thanks to all of you listening. And at the controls, a big thank you, as always, to Joanne Marr. I'm Robert Wyman. Be safe and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.